Hi, thanks for checking out Press Play and our podcast. And when you're done with this one, I have another one that you're going to love. I just know it. It's a podcast about design and architecture, cars, gadgets, all sorts of things that make up our built and beautiful world. It's hosted by someone who is an insider who knows everything about design and architecture, Frances Anderton, and the podcast is called DNA. It's on KCRW's iTunes page, so check it out.
Waves are pounding the Washington coast this morning already. They've already swept some homes into the water. They threaten more.
California this morning is bracing for the strongest storm to hit the West Coast in more than 6 years. Heavy rain and winds threaten to bring trees and power lines down.
The afternoon and early evening hours, we're going to start to see some rain over the central coast of California. And then finally, Southern California getting hit in the overnight and early morning hours.
Potential for high surf is causing big concerns along beaches in Los Angeles. Crews built sand berms to prevent flooding, since waves could reach two stories tall.
A powerful storm is already flooding parts of the Bay Area. Power is out in parts of San Francisco. Hundreds of flights are canceled, and that storm is headed our way later today. Of course, California has been going through a monster drought, and we need the rain. There's concern that climate change is going to make this kind of long, dry spell the norm. So what kind of rainfall can we expect here in Southern California in the coming years, in the coming decades? A new study from UCLA looks at that question. One of the authors is Alex Hall. He's a professor in UCLA's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So we keep hearing that the drought could be a 100-year drought, that the dry spell that we've been having despite this incoming storm is really going to be the norm. But your study shows that that's not the case.
No, that's not the case. We certainly expect dry spells to happen in the future. But on average, our study shows that precipitation changes are unlikely to change dramatically in the future.
Well, what does that mean? How much rain will we be getting?
Most likely we'll be getting, on average, again, similar amounts to what we have experienced over the past century. There, of course, there's uncertainty in those numbers. We don't know for sure what will happen, and we can't predict in any given year how much rain will fall. But if we look at average numbers, we expect numbers that are pretty similar to what we have now.
So should this be taken as a huge sigh of relief that we aren't going to be experiencing this multi-year drought that we've all feared?
Well, I think that we'll definitely experience droughts in the future, and I think that climate change will challenge our ability to confront the consequences of those droughts. So one component of changing climate is warming, and so when you have warmer temperatures, you have more evaporation. That increases water consumption. That also reduces water supplies.
Hmm.
And so I think we're already seeing in this current drought, we are having difficulty coping with it because soil moisture levels are very low and consumption is very high because we're in a warmer climate. So I don't think this means that we will have an easy time coping with dry spells. I think there are other aspects of climate change that will challenge us.
And one of those issues is that more rain and warmer temperatures also means less snow.
Yes, that's another dimension of climate change. So what we're seeing now, we've had three studies now come out on climate change in the Los Angeles region. Of course, there are many other studies in California looking at climate change. I think there's a picture emerging of various impacts, and you have to look at them holistically. So if you look at the warming component, that does affect water resources. I already mentioned the evaporation component, but there's also the fact that snow melt will be accelerated and we'll also have less precipitation falling as snow and more as rain. And that will also change the water resources picture in California pretty dramatically.
And a lot of rain all at once or spread out throughout the winter?
So that's something that we didn't look at in our study. There are other studies that show that it's likely that we'll have more precipitation falling in extreme events, much like the one that we're about to experience, very heavy rain, intense rain coming in short bursts. And that, of course, is a challenge for flooding. And that's another aspect of climate change that, you know, we didn't look at specifically in this study, but certainly is a cause for concern.
How much hotter is it going to be?
Well, we looked at warming over the course of the coming century under a scenario of greenhouse gas emissions that involves what we call business as usual, where the emissions keep increasing unabated. And, you know, we find pretty substantial warming by the end of the century on the order of 4 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on where you are in the region. So that will lead to pretty dramatic changes in how we experience the climate in the region.
So within some of our lifetimes, the youngest among us, that will occur, 4 to 7 degrees increase.
Yes. Yeah, so if you think of it in terms of generations, there's our children's generation, and there's our grandchildren's generation, and it's that generation, I think, that will be, confronting the consequences of the decisions that we make now about how much greenhouse gases to put into the atmosphere.
Alex Hall, professor in UCLA's Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, co-author of a new study published today in the Journal of Climate. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Marty Adams is here now. He's the second in command in charge of water at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Hi, Marty.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine, thanks. Looking forward to the rain. Alex just mentioned that storms like the one we're about to experience, heavy, intense storms, are more likely to be the norm in the future. And so does the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power have a plan to capture some of that water?
We do. And as a matter of fact, the UCLA study that just came out really validates what we had thought would work with our projects for the future to help bolster our local water supply. So we know we have a lot more intense rains, that we can count on continued rains in the future. So our plans are to be able to set up a better system to capture that water as it runs off, to keep it from getting into the LA River and then to the Pacific Ocean, where it's lost forever. And so we want to capture as much as we can, get it into the groundwater basins, and have it become part of our local water supply.
So what are we doing? How are we going to capture the rain that falls tonight?
Well, there's a lot of existing infrastructure that's in place that we've been working very closely with our partners at the LA County Public Works to capture as much stormwater as possible behind the major detention dams and the spreading basins. Then at the same time, we have a number of new projects that we're working toward that'll do capture in smaller areas, some of these green street projects and projects that'll help infiltrate water in local neighborhoods. And there's a few of those up and running, but we need to build a lot more.
Yeah, I think there's only really one in LA, right?
Well, we have one on Elmer Avenue. We also have a new median project in the valley as well. So there's but this is going to become the norm because a lot of the stormwater doesn't reach the major spreading grounds. And so we need to intercept more water on its way to the ocean and get as much as we can into the aquifer so we can use it again in the future. It's really critical for our future local water supply.
And then Alex also mentioned that we're not going to be getting as much snow. So the snowpack, which is a vital source of water, just won't be there.
Well, that's a big concern because, so much of the state's water supply is reserved in snow. Snow is almost like a reservoir for the state. So as we see less snow and more rain, there may be the same volume of water, but it's going to come down faster and it's going to run off faster. And so there's going to be a lot of new infrastructure that's needed in the state to make sure that we can capture more of that runoff before it gets away, because it will be different than what we've experienced in the past.
So you're saying all these plans are being looked at and being discussed seriously, but how far away are we from actually having a widespread water capture system?
Well, there's plans that are actually things in construction for improving the infrastructure that we have already so it can capture more water than it has in the past. And then, of course, there's plans that are probably 3 or 4 years out for new infrastructure pieces. We're currently working with the mayor's water cabinet on some interim ideas, things that we normally would not have thought of doing, but maybe things that aren't even permanent, but ways to use any open space, any public space available to try to catch whatever water we can. So there's, I think, in the next few months, there'll be probably a series of projects in areas where stormwater capture is good for infiltration. It's like the San Fernando Valley, projects that maybe involve some park space and other open space in places of the public right of way. So Department of Water and Power, LA Sanitation, and Department of Rec and Parks are looking to partner on some projects that'll catch water this winter that were previously not on the books.
And how much water do you think you can capture that way?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it takes a lot of little projects to add up to a lot of water. Just the improvements in the spreading grounds will allow a lot more water captured than we have in the past. We've typically captured 25 to 30,000 acre feet of water a year. Our long range goal is to at least triple that. So, but if we can make any efforts toward that goal this winter, then that'll be very important for the city.
Marty Adams, second in command in charge of water at the Los Angeles DWP. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much.
Washington's getting into the act, too. The House passed a California drought relief bill earlier this week. The bill would pave the way for water from Northern California to be diverted to Southern California and the Central Valley during winter storms. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy and other Central Valley Republicans pushed for it. And pushing back? Well, Senate Democrats, the president, Governor Jerry Brown, and environmentalists. So it seems unlikely it'll go any further. But the behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing over the bill shows an escalation in the power struggle over water between agribusiness and environmentalists and the lawmakers who are caught in between. Joining us now is Michael Hiltzik. He is business columnist for the LA Times. Hi, Michael.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Nice to have you. Well, earlier this year, both the Senate and the House passed a different California drought relief bill. What happened after that?
Well, they couldn't come together on an agreement, and Senator Dianne Feinstein, as we know, tried to craft an agreement sort of in secret, certainly behind closed doors, that she could have enacted just as Congress was leaving in this lame duck session. That really fell apart, so she has now said she's going to bring up a bill under regular order next year, which means the provisions are going to be well aired, they're going to be subjected to hearings, it's all going to be done out in the open, and I think we can probably all agree that's a good thing. That's the right way to deal with a problem that really involves a lot of stakeholders from the north to the south of the state.
Well, why was she operating in secret, and who was she working with?
Well, she was working with the Republicans in Congress, in the House. She said she was working in secret because you had to come up with something efficiently before you could actually put it up for a vote. The suspicion, obviously, when legislators do something like that is that she was really representing, or all of them were representing, special interests that were looking for something. That was a real mistake, I think a real blunder, because there are so many interests that are involved in water in California. As she said herself, this subject in California is driven by water rights law, it's driven by history, it's driven by environmental concerns, it's driven by politics, and all of those factors have really become anachronistic because of changes in the climate, changes in our water supply over the years. It all really needs to be aired comprehensively in one big package, and it needs to be done in public.
Mm-hmm. And some of the people, there are some very powerful interests behind this. I mentioned earlier, the billionaires behind the Palm Wonderful Empire. This is Stuart and Linda Resnick. Tell us about their involvement and why they're so invested in this issue.
Well, of course, they are among the biggest water users in the state, in the Central Valley. They've got almond trees. They've got pistachios. Some of their neighbors, big agribusinesses, also in the Westlands Water District, which is roughly adjacent to where the Resnicks big farms are, also have almonds and pistachio. I think we can say that given what we know about water supply in California, these are probably the wrong crops to have planted in the Central Valley because they're permanent crops. They can't really survive a break in the water supply. And under the circumstances, we are going to have breaks in the water supply. We're going to have reductions because we have to accommodate these other interests. We have to make sure that the environmental needs of the Delta are honored. We have to make sure that the water quality needs of the Delta are honored. And that means we can't steer all this water. We can't give these big farms the priority that they've had in the past. And that means that all of this stuff has to be discussed. There have to be new ways of apportioning water in California, and it can't be done just if one interest is viewed as prime over all the others.
And the Resnicks, too, are big Democratic donors.
They are big donors. They're close to Dianne Feinstein. She's done a lot for them. She's represented their interests before federal agencies. in the past. I think she realizes that there's more at stake, but politics, you know, in politics, money talks and influence talks, and I think that's a lot of what we've seen go on here.
Well, they would argue, I'm sure, and as would other farmers, that their interests are vital not only to California, but to the rest of the nation and the world, in fact, which buys a lot of our produce.
Well, I think anybody who's got a special interest or who is a special interest believes that they have a moral or an economic cause that everybody else should believe in. I think their claims really have to be weighed against the claims and the interests of everybody else who's got a stake in water in California. We can't just take it as read. We can't take it as gospel.
Now, the governor has spoken out against this particular bill, but he's pushing for his own drought relief plan, the Delta Tunnel Project. It would help these same agricultural interests, right? So what does that mean?
Well, it would help them in some ways. It would be against their interests in others. I think one of the important things about the governor's point of view is that he understands that this is something that really that the state really needs to address comprehensively. It can't be done behind closed doors in Washington, where some stakeholders are at the table and other stakeholders are not at the table. So the state of California over the years has really contrived a fairly complex system of apportioning water, of overcoming some of these historical rights and historical interests. And it's I think the governor is uncomfortable, as he should be, as we all should be, for the system that we've set up in the state, as flawed as it is, to be overrun by Washington.
Can it be solved without Washington, though?
Well,
in
no,
word,
it probably cannot be solved. It can't be solved without Washington, because Washington has a real interest and has been involved in water in California for years, but it cannot be solved by Washington alone.
All right. Thank you so much. Michael Hiltzik, business columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up on the program, a new Pentagon report says 6,000 people were sexually assaulted in the military this year. That's about double the rate in civilian life. What's being done about it? That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is promising new legislation that would take the prosecution of military sexual assaults out of the chain of command. She says there's a conflict of interest because commanders are often too close to the people involved. And that push is gaining new urgency in light of a new Pentagon report on military sexual assault. The Pentagon says that more service members are willing to report sexual assaults, but there were nearly 6,000 sexual assaults this year. That works out to about 16 a day. The report also found that a majority who reported a sexual assault experienced some form of retaliation, either social or professional. Helen Benedict is a professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book Sand Queen and The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the Pentagon is trumpeting this report, saying basically it's proof that victims feel more comfortable coming forward and that they trust military authorities more, and that increased reporting of sexual assaults is a good thing because it means that women are finally reporting these incidents more. So what do you make of that?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that this report is the Pentagon studying its own business. You know, an internal report. So it's not, you always have to take that with a grain of salt when somebody releases a report on themselves. And they've always put a good spin on it, whatever the numbers are, if they can. But that said, there does seem to be indication that the reporting is going better. I mean, for years and years and years, 80 to 90% of women and men who were sexually assaulted were never reported it in the military because it was too intimidating. So now they're saying it's more like a quarter. And that's better, but the intimidation hasn't changed, and that's terrifying and dangerous and not good enough at all.
And what does that mean? Could you flesh that out a little bit, to be intimidated or retaliated
against?
Sure.
I mean, I can use examples of soldiers I've talked to where one reported a rape by her sergeant, and she was then punished by him because he was her boss, and she was made to walk around the compound in Iraq where they were deployed with a chicken hanging around her neck to make a food of her. I've heard of other incidences where, to shut women up who report rape, they've been sent off on latrine duty, which is the most disgusting job on a base, and often means that they're being sent way out or way far away from where most people are, which puts them in more danger of attack. The most extreme one I heard was somebody who was actually court-martialed because she said she couldn't redeploy after a break with her sergeant who had been raping her. She was court-martialed for desertion and put in the brig for a month. So it's quite a serious situation. It's important to remember that there's no organization in America or probably anywhere that gives individuals as much power over other individuals as the military does. And there are always going to be people who use that power, manipulate it, to victimize people and then to shut them up.
So that's why Senator Gillibrand wants to strip commanders of the power to prosecute sexual assaults. But another woman in the Senate, Claire McCaskill, she is also fighting the military sexual assault issue, but she thinks that sexual assault cases should not be taken out of the chain of command. And I'm just wondering why that is such a hot-button issue in terms of where these cases are prosecuted.
Yes. The generals who've been on McCaskill's side have said that taking anything away from them like that, any sort of power or control away from them, undermines their authority, and that they should have authority to run their own units, their own companies. And that's been the biggest argument, and it's the one that defeated Senator Gillibrand's bill. I might point out, though, that in Britain and in Canada, for 20 years at least, sexual assaults have been handled outside of the military and in civilian courts in order to circumvent the built-in conflict of interest. I mean, it isn't only that the commander might be friends with the accused, but the commander also has his own career and reputation to protect. So he'd have a good reason not to want to let these cases come to light, because it would make him look like a bad leader.
Is there a parallel to be drawn with the campus sexual assault system, that a lot of these cases, when they are brought up, when women come forward on campuses saying that they've been assaulted, that those are handled internally as well on campus?
Yes, in both cases, these are institutions trying to protect their own reputation. The difference is the chain of command is a different thing in the military than this, you know, it doesn't exist in the same way at all on campuses. But we saw it in the church, we're still seeing it in the church too, institutions that like to suppress their epidemics of sexual assault because they need to protect their reputations. And in the case of campuses, they don't want parents to become afraid to send their children there. I just would like to add, it's not just women. In fact, in raw numbers, there are more men who reported rape in the military than women.
There has been broad bipartisan support for Senator Gillibrand's legislative action on this issue. Do you think that she will have enough votes to get this through this time around?
I'm not sure. It may be that the positive side of this new Pentagon report will act against her, because the military can now stand up and say, look, we're doing so much better. We don't need your bill. So if that happens, I'm not positive that she will win. However, I was just before we got on air here, I was scrolling through the new report, trying to find, which is enormous, trying to find the statistics on actual prosecution, because one of the things that's been so shocking in the military is the minuscule percentage of prosecutions that were actually successful against assailants, and the pathetic punishments, the slaps on the wrists they were getting. And it does look like it's getting better, but it's still nowhere near good enough. And it's not as good as it is even in civilian life, which is bad enough.
Mm. Well, 6,000 sexual assaults in a year. Can you put that in context? How does that compare with civilian life?
Well, put it this way, in the research I've done, within the time that people serve, which for most people is 8 years unless they go in for life, the chances if you're a woman of being sexually assaulted are about 1 in 3. That's how it's been traditionally for a long time. In civilian life, the chances of you being sexually assaulted in your whole lifetime is 1 in 6. The other thing I might say about this report is that for several years now, the Pentagon keeps changing the way it counts and the way it does its statistics. So it's very hard. It's done it again this year. It's very hard to compare year by year when they keep changing the rules.
And where is the president on this? Does he have a role to play? And could he, in effect, order the military to do this and take it out of the Senate's hands?
Yes, he's the commander-in-chief. I mean, in some ways, he's been more progressive. He's the only president I know of who's actually even spoken about sexual assault to the public, sexual assault in the military. So at least he's done that. And there has been response within the military. But on the other hand, the leaders of the military have been mouthing the zero tolerance phrase for decades. And, you know, that hasn't meant anything.
Helen Benedict, professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book Sand Queen and The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Helen Benedict, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the elite group of lawyers the Supreme Court hears from over and over again. They mainly represent corporate interests, how they decide which cases get heard and which decided, and how that affects the law of the land, after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Supreme Court seems to have added a new criterion when deciding whether to take a case. It's not just the merits of the case itself, it's the lawyer who's bringing the case. That's according to a new investigation by Reuters. A small group of elite lawyers is much more likely to have their cases heard by the Supreme Court than other lawyers, and that elite group largely represents the interests of big business. Joan Piskupic led the investigation for Reuters. She's the editor-in-charge of Reuters' legal affairs team. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
So there's this tiny group of lawyers, as you report. Can you just put it in context, give us some scale here? Of all the petitions filed, how many do they file and how many get their cases heard before the Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court has complete discretion over which appeals they take up. And they received about 14,000 petitions over the last 9 years from private parties. This wasn't from governments, not from the federal government or the state. And we looked back at these roughly 14,000 petitions that had the names of 17,000 lawyers on them. And we isolated on 66 who had a remarkable success rate. And that's really something. That's less than 1% of all the lawyers who filed. But these key lawyers were involved in 43% of the cases the court chose to decide from that specific period, 2004 to 2012.
Just 66 out of 17,000. And who are these 66?
Well, some of them are very familiar in the legal world, but none of them are household names. I'll mention a few that some of your listeners might know. Ted Olson, who was the former Solicitor General of the United States under George W. Bush, who has actually done mostly corporate work before the Supreme Court, but recently was associated with the Proposition 8 same-sex marriage challenge from California. So he's one of them. Other former solicitors general would include Paul Clement and Seth Waxman. But I just want to say, for these 66 most successful lawyers, 51 work for law firms that primarily represent corporate interests. So in cases pitting the interests of consumers, employees, and other individuals against those companies, one of these leading attorneys was three times more likely to launch an appeal for business than for an individual. That gives you a little bit of the flavor of the 66 in terms of their corporate identifications. And then I'll just add quickly, Madeline, that we also found of these 66, they were quite insular. 63 of these lawyers were white, only 8 were women. 31 had worked as a law clerk to a justice behind the scenes, and 25 had worked in the prestigious office of the U.S. Solicitor General, which represents the federal government before the court.
So quite an insular group. And you say that many of them, most of them, work for firms that represent corporate interests. When they take cases before the Supreme Court, are they also representing corporate interests?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The business of law is often business, and much of the litigation throughout America that federal judges take up involves businesses, businesses being sued by their customers, businesses suing other businesses. So there's a certain propensity that you're going to have big businesses in the federal courts and big businesses before the U.S. Supreme Court. But we found that the corporate tilt seemed to be deeper. And one thing we pointed out to readers is that when you have this elite squad mainly representing business, they essentially are precluded from opportunities to represent the other side. And that's because there's conflicts of interest, naturally, that anyone who's representing a corporation as part of his or her law firm work is going to be barred, based on conflicts of interest, from representing someone who comes from the other side. That's just sort of natural. And when we mentioned this at various points to the Supreme Court justices who don't feel that anything really unfair is going on, they said, well, look, there are other lawyers who come in from the law school clinics who represent individuals with grievances, or people with small law practices who, despite being of a small practice, tend to be quite prominent and successful, and they represent consumers often. And what we found when we went back to those lawyers, they acknowledged that they love to get the business and they love that they are included in this Core 66. But they also said, look, we can only do so much. Law firm clinics usually have 2 law professors who oversee the work and rotating groups of students. And then the small law firms who tend to have boutique appellate practices also are limited in how many cases they can take up, limited in a way that the big corporate firms would not be.
So you're talking about who actually brings the cases and how the cases are chosen to be heard. But once they are chosen, there has to be a lawyer on the other side arguing the other side. Is that lawyer just not as qualified as the
No. In fact, Madeline, you just asked a really important question that I want to make sure that listeners understand, that we're talking about two different fields. The really hard part to get a case before the Supreme Court is just simply to get a case taken up by the Supreme Court and subjected to oral arguments. And so that was our first group, as I said, the 17,000 lawyers, some 14,000 petitions, narrowed down to 66. That's the really heavy lift, to somehow get the attention of these justices. But then what you just asked about is also critical, but it might not be as problematic in terms of a tilt. We still have an insularity on that side, though. When the court accepts a case, and it's two, you know, dueling parties, somebody, you know, maybe with a corporation, somebody with the government side, or somebody with a corporation, somebody with the employee side, you will find that very prominent, experienced lawyers will rush in to represent whatever side might not have super quality experience representing it. So we did find that there seemed to be sufficient lawyering once a case was granted and was going to be tested on the merits. But even at that stage, we saw a new insularity. Of all the cases that were argued in the last decade by private lawyers, 8 key men, and they were all men, dominated in 20%. When we went back 10 years prior and looked at who dominated in 20% of the cases, there were 30 private lawyers. So you can see, Madeline, we've had a real contraction at both ends. And with the oral arguments, clients on both sides are turning more and more to this core group. And when we isolated on that group, they were all 8 white men. Again, as I said, the whole bar at these two phases, both the petitioning and the oral arguments, has really contracted.
I'm speaking with Reuters journalist Joan Biskupic. Her new investigation into an elite group of lawyers that dominate the Supreme Court's docket is out now. And what I found interesting was that every single Supreme Court justice you interviewed for this story, and Chief Justice Roberts declined to be interviewed, he was the only one, they all dismissed any questions of fairness, you know, no matter what their political leanings. They all said that, look, these lawyers who come to us are the ones who are the best prepared to bring a case. They're the ones who have researched the case. They won't make mistakes in oral arguments. They rely on these lawyers because they are the best of the best. And so what's wrong with that?
I was really interested in the justices' reaction, and I actually went to the more liberal ones first because I thought the liberal ones, while they would definitely appreciate the experience and expertise of the bar as it now stands at the Supreme Court, that they would have wanted a little bit more diversity, and again, using that word very broadly, or be worried that there was a certain corporate sensibility coming from this growing insularity collectively. But I didn't find that. I found that they felt, to a person, that these folks help tee up cases and help them do their jobs. Now, we're talking about nine very smart individuals on the U.S. Supreme Court who have teams of very smart law clerks helping them, but they have come to be dependent in some ways on these elite practitioners, and I was frankly surprised to hear how strongly they were stating it. I think that a lot of people can understand the fact that this is a very specialized kind of legal practice. But what critics say is what you have now is a group of elite justices hearing from a group of elite lawyers, and it's caused a narrowing of the public conversation at the expense of democracy and broad legal thought in America.
Right. So you said that almost half of these 66 had been law clerks for the Supreme Court justices, and many of them also socialize with the justices, which doesn't happen in the lower courts. There are rules forbidding that kind of socializing. They know them personally, and so is that also a reason why they're likely to more likely to take their cases and more likely to look upon those cases favorably?
There are rules about socializing with lawyers in the lower courts. It's not forbidden. It's just, you know, a lot of good judgment written into their codes of conduct. The U.S. Supreme Court doesn't have an official one in terms of the socialization with friends. I don't think it's the friendship. I actually don't. I think it's the reliance on repeat players, familiar players, people who inspire some confidence among the justices who they start to feel comfortable with. And Charles Ogletree, a Harvard law professor, said the nature of the law isn't just to, you know, make the justices feel more comfortable with the advocate before them, but to sort of broaden their thinking about a legal issue. And I think that's what's happened, is that there's this codependency that's developed. There are fewer voices that are being heard at the apex of the federal judiciary.
When did this all start happening?
Well, in the mid-1980s, a man by the name of Rex Lee, who was Ronald Reagan's first Solicitor General, went into private practice and began building up an appellate specialty before the Supreme Court on behalf of business. And that developed over the years. All the big firms started doing that. And there was, frankly, a widening at one point of, you know, experienced appellate practitioners before the court. But then what happened, this contraction started. And part of it has to do with the Supreme Court itself was starting to take fewer and fewer cases. Since the 1980s, it has essentially cut its caseload in half in terms of what it will hear. So there became much more competition. So people who had had more experience and were from, you know, a certain kind of traditional law firm probably had the edge. And that's exactly why, as our U.S. Supreme Court itself has gotten more diverse, we don't have that kind of diversity percentage-wise in terms of the private bar that appears before the justices.
So how does it change? I mean, it seems to be a chicken and egg kind of situation that we have right now. And so if it doesn't seem like the justices see that there's a problem with it, and so how would more diverse viewpoints, more diverse cases be brought and accepted to the court if the justices aren't interested?
Well, I think, first of all, there needs to be a certain awareness. And Reuters looked at this data in a way that no one else had ever done. I was someone who had watched the court for many years and had a hunch that things were different. I had noticed that fewer lawyers, this core group of elite, seemed to be getting more of their clients' cases heard. But we thought, let's just see if the hunch comes through. And I actually think that some of the justices will be have been very surprised by the numbers and surprised by the echoing of sentiment among them and this echo chamber that we have tried to reveal.
So you think that after reading your stories, they might think, oh, my gosh, maybe we need to broaden this out a bit?
Well, I wonder if they'll think when they're looking at petitions that might not be so precisely framed, not have the deep years of experience behind them, that they might sometimes think there's an important legal issue here. It might not be framed as well as some of our regulars can frame it, but nonetheless, it's very important, and maybe we can compensate in some way. I do think that they hadn't really looked at it through this lens. They hadn't looked at it through the lens of what are the consequences of this deepening insularity? What are the consequences? I don't think they had, first of all, acknowledged it that much. They were certainly acknowledging that the quality of the lawyers who were appearing before them had gotten better, but they hadn't looked at the flip side in terms of any potential cost or consequence. And as I say, when I raised it, they said, oh, but the law school clinics are there and some of these men from smaller firms can help out. But I think having those individuals also quoted in the story saying, well, you know, in all reality, we can't do what some of these justices might be thinking that we're doing, could, as I say, broaden their understanding of what might be happening just within their own courtroom.
Joan Biskupic, she's editor in charge of Reuters' legal affairs team, and her investigation into the elite group of lawyers that dominates the Supreme Court docket is out now at Reuters. Thank you, Joan, very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Hello, Warren Olney.
Hello there.
Tell us what's up at 1 o'clock.
We are going to talk extensively about the Rolling Stone article on the sexual assault at the University of Virginia, which turns out to have been wrong in so many ways, and what that means and how very difficult it is to report on that and what the rules ought to be. And we will hear also from John Brennan, his defense of the CIA against the Intelligence Committee report of the U.S. Senate.
Okay, that sounds like must listening to me. 1 o'clock, to the point with Warren Olney.
Don't miss
Thank
it.
You. I won't. Coming up on this show, he built a brand based on homoerotic images of shirtless teenage boys, how Mike Jeffries created and then lost the Abercrombie and Fitch empire. Next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you were a teenager in the late 90s or the parent of one, you know the sway that the clothing company Abercrombie & Fitch held over its customers. Notorious for its shirtless guys in its catalogs and its overwhelming in-store fragrance, the company was a hit with a lot of kids. But now, the CEO who built the brand, Mike Jeffries, is out. Jeffries was unable to adapt during the recession and to the rise of fast fashion houses like H&M and Forever 21. Benoit Denizet-Lewis is a writer for the New York Times Magazine, and he spent some quality time with Jeffries for a story several years ago. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, nice to have you. So he was famous, Jeffries, famously obsessive about what the person who shops at Abercrombie should look like. And he told you for this article that you wrote that he marketed only to the hot, popular kids. Why would he say something like that?
Well, you know, he didn't have much of a filter. And that was part of what made him such an interesting profile subject for me. I mean, this was back in 2006. I went out to his the Abercrombie headquarters, which is this this vast compound in the Ohio woods, a beautiful compound in the Ohio woods, and not many people had been let into that world at that point. And I can sort of see why now, because he doesn't have much of a filter, so he says things. He said things to me out loud that probably other folks in the business think privately, but he just spoke very candidly about wanting cool kids to wear his clothes, not wanting overweight or unattractive kids, the importance of getting sort of the influencer of a group to wear Abercrombie clothes. So he said he really opened up in a way, and then I think he got very worried about how much he'd opened up because he had one of his deputies politely ask me to leave after I'd been there for a couple days. So it was a fascinating experience, though, because not many people have written about Mike, and he is such a strange, fascinating, hugely successful, and hugely influential person on our culture and our fashion, especially in the 90s.
Yeah.
He's just a fascinating man on a number of levels, because he's sort of tried to both remake himself in his image too. Like, he's had clearly had a lot of surgery done, and he wears Abercrombie clothes, and he's an older man, but he's really trying to reinvent himself in many ways, and sort of try to have the attitude of his ideal Abercrombie guy, which is sort of a carefree early 20s masculine man.
Yeah. Right, which was, I guess, really popular for a while in the 90s. It was kind of a conservative look, right? I mean, I'm talking about it in the past tense, but it's still around. It had this preppy look and sweatshirts.
Yeah.
And just describe it for people who aren't familiar.
Yeah, I mean, it's very preppy, collegiate, sort of baggy. It was still upscale. I mean, it cost a good amount of money, and that was a sort of a huge point of contention over the years, because Mike sort of refused to do what so many other retailers were doing, which was to discount his merchandise. He wouldn't do it. He had this sense of what the value was for his clothing, and he didn't want to hurt his brand. So when a lot of people were calling for him to make discounts, he wouldn't do it. But what's so fascinating about his aesthetic and really his aesthetic was that it was so popular among both straight and gay people. It was this brand that was so clearly homoerotic, especially in its advertising. But yet that seems to sort of go right over the heads of the young sort of heterosexual guys who would wear proudly sort of wear the clothes. And then you had a lot of
heterosexual guys really like Queen too, so you know.
But he got
into trouble though with a lot of people for just pushing those boundaries way too far. I mean, he had thongs for middle school girls.
Yeah, that said eye candy and wink wink on them. Yeah. And I asked him about that, and that was really sort of the point of contention when I was out there spending a few days with him. I was just asking what any journalist would do sort of about the controversies, and he got very, very defensive about them and talked about the world being cynical and everyone being cynical, and he wasn't a cynical person. He used that word a lot, and he really got very sweaty and got very sort of angry, in a sense that people were suggesting that his intentions were anything but good. And so that was one of the many controversies. I mean, what was remarkable about Abercrombie and Fitch were just how many controversies there were over the year, whether it was African-American employees suing him, saying that the store managers are pushing them in the back and not letting them work in the front of the store, to what he was writing on T-shirts. They had a way of practically upsetting everyone, but it was a formula that worked in a sense, because it upset the people that really didn't matter, in a sense, and then the people who still wanted to wear the clothes would. I mean, it sort of made it almost more popular.
But I guess the shareholders have had enough, and they said it ultimately damaged the brand. So now that he's out, do you have any sense of where he'll end up next or what his legacy is?
I have no clue. He hasn't talked to me in many years after that piece. Although I thought it was I tried to write as fair a piece as I could. But I don't know what he'll do. I mean, he's made a lot of money. He's had a huge influence. I mean, people try to downplay that influence, but he really shaped a generation's fashion sense.
For good or ill, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Benoit Denizet-Lewis. He's a New York Times Magazine contributor. Were you an Abercrombie girl, Jilly Myers?
So I wanted to be. Let me...
You're just going to be honest about it.
Let me be transparent. Abercrombie & Fitch was the uniform of cool kids when I was in middle school, but I was not a cool kid. It was $40 for a t-shirt.
Maybe by being uncool, not. Maybe by being uncool, you actually were the
coolest. I'm actually kind of glad that I wasn't cool. We asked our Facebook friends and Twitter followers what the cool kid brand was at their middle school or high school. Jeff Hammock on Facebook says that first Izod rocked the cool kids world and then Polo took over. So preppy. Horacio Olvera tweeted us, first he says, pay no attention to how old he sounds when he says this, but the cool kids were all about members only and Le Tigre when he was in school. But Anna G. Rojas says that at her school, you were made fun of if you bought the It brand clothes. It was all about pretending you didn't care. The less you cared, the cooler you were. That would make me about the coolest person in the world at this point, I think. Cool kids wear sweatpants outside of the house, right?
No.
No,
sorry.
I'm still a dork.
In my day, it was Dittos and Familiares.
I don't know what that is.
Of which I had neither. All right. So, Jilly Myers, thank you for that walk down memory lane.
Of course.
And if you want to walk down memory lane, we would love to walk with you on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play, or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.